session number 30304.
So it ran at reel 11. Ted, what was the next stage for you then, obviously, as you'd finished at Little Risington?
Well, at Little Risington, I can't remember anyone who didn't pass the course and ready to go to the squadrons. The twin-engine people, or Anson people, went to Bomber Command, OTUs, as they were called, and there were only two of us, my great colleague Henry Hall and myself, posted to Coastal Command. I was glad about that because I'd already begun to understand the very great problems facing Bomber Command. It had been said that in the early years of the war it was much more dangerous to do low-level attacks on shipping and fly low and so on single missions, rather than fly at night in Bomber Command, because of course there wasn't all that much ACAC, or FLAC as the Germans preferred to call it, and there was a lot to do in Bomber Command to get better results on target, and all these things came to pass. But it was pretty obvious at the beginning that there was a lot of difference in the three commands in type of flying and experience that one might have. Obviously, Fighter Command explains itself, and the lads who went into there obviously enjoyed flying their wonderful machines very much. I wasn't built for that, I don't think, but I was built for Coastal Command, I think. What I didn't like to do is be given instructions which had to be carried out if the mission was going to be a success. I don't mean by that that I objected in any way to the desirability of achieving such ambitions. There were ambitions at that stage in order to be able to deal with the German military as was needed. The beauty about Coastal Command, it seemed to me, was that you had much more individual responsibility. Just to give a simple example, out at sea there is a convoy or even an individual ship in the Atlantic somewhere which is on its own. It may have, or probably would have, naval protection. Wonderful little corvettes were the special boats made for that sort of purpose. But it was on its own and it was out in hundreds of square miles of water. You were in Coastal Command, excuse me, at an airfield which would more than likely be near the coast, for obvious reasons, and you were given the position, the approximate, the hoped for position of this convoy, and there were U-boats about, and you had to plot your own track, the way you wanted to take it, to go and meet it, and if you didn't meet it, then you had to carry out either a square search or a line ahead or a line astern search and so on. You had to take decisions. And the one occasion on which I flew with Bomber Command certainly didn't fulfill those needs. We had our own excitement, but to be told to fly a certain course at a certain height, at a certain time. And I think a great deal of the people, the chaps who were doing that. I was just pleased that I was in coastal command. Alternatively, of course, on the other side of the country, as it were, Atlantic on one side, North Sea on the other, and particularly from Wick, when we were there at the time of the crisis in because of the loss of shipping to U-boats, the North Sea also gave us responsibilities in that there would be iron ore ships, German ships, taking this much needed high grade iron ore down the coast of Norway. And one single aircraft might be sent out to on reconnaissance to gather information about, and also to attack it if circumstances should be propitious. Indeed, that was the way Henry, poor chap, was shot down. He was just going to attack a convoy off the Norwegian coast and prevented from doing so. So I was very happy to be posted to Coastal Command and went up to Silloth for conversion to the Hudson aircraft.
Can I just ask there at that stage, Ted, what degree of knowledge did you have at that time of the roles of Coastal Command? Because obviously you've explained your preference for it, but were you aware of these roles and that what Coastal Command's role was actually at that time? Was there much awareness as you were posted from training to the command?
Yes. Well, certainly I was aware of it. I think most people could be. There were these reports of what happened to convoys, particularly during 1940, when the convoys in the English Channel were very savagely attacked, and it was well reported, and of course seen by local people. So that would obviously be one of the roles of Coastal Command, to try and protect the convoys, which were essential. It was essential for them to have free movement up and down the channel. The other thing was that we were told, during the training, I can't remember at which stage, that there were four Hudson squadrons which had been able to release to the Navy the naval squadrons which in the First World War had to be on constant patrol over the North Sea against the German Navy and the incursions of both surface ships and U-boats, well, early U-boats, anyway. So that was how I came to realize the need for reconnaissance of the enemy's coastline and the need for some cover to be provided for shipping, both sailing independently and also in convoy. There was some debate, I think quite early in the war, as to whether the convoy system, which was already beginning to operate, whether it was a good idea or not. These things really were public, so it didn't take much thought to realize where your particular responsibility might lie according to which command you joined.
see you posted up to Silloth.
Yeah.
What was the airfield like?
Well, like most airfields I came across, and I think it was pretty general, beginning of the war, it was a grass airfield. As had been a little Rissington, which meant, of course, and still means, that you can always take off into wind. We did that. It was quite close to the small town of Silloth. The facilities were quite good. The Solway Firth was a good area in which to practice the various skills that one needed, particularly low-level flying. Excuse me. And things went pretty well. I had a good instructor. And the aircraft, of course, was strange in many ways. And so it took a bit of getting used to, because it had a number of extra facilities which wasn't going to appear, which weren't, sorry, going to appear on many British aircraft until 1942. It was early in 1942, I think, when it was deemed that every aircraft in Bomber Command should have automatic pilots. So there we were with a Hudson, going round, having a look, and we had this marvellous panel in front of us, which was an automatic pilot. That, in fact, of course, I think it took us more by surprise than anything else. It was the first we ever heard of the thing. It also had Fowler flaps, and I think we mentioned before the flaps that are the ailerons, as they're officially called, the back of each wing, between the middle of the wing and the leading edge, and the trailing edge, whereas the flaps on most other types of aircraft, and certainly Anson, just simply hinged down, on the Hudson there was an extended runner piece on the back of the wing, so that the flap not only went down, hinged down, but ran down these runners to extend the cord of the wing. In other words, there was more wing surface when the flaps were down than when they were in position. And of course, there's more wing surface than there would have been if the flap had simply been a hinge part of the aileron, as with most other aircraft. That took a bit of getting used to, because it could be dangerous, and the aircraft just dropped like a stone if you put it, what was known as 100% flap down. It was very seldom used. But I do understand that some Hudsons in later use, 1943 perhaps onwards, when it was possible to get into occupied countries, and particularly France, with longer or larger air landing spaces, that pilots were able to use 100% flap to get almost sort of climb down the hedges and get down. I've used it once or twice myself. It really is quite effective and frightening. Anyway, those were the two main differences. There was, of course, much more power in the aircraft, and various other facilities. There were, in all, in and around the pilot in the Hudson cockpit, 97, I think it was, different switches, controls, things to press or twiddle.
Can you give me a thumbnail sketch of what the aircraft looked like?
It looked as though it was going to have a baby Hudson. It was rather fat in the tummy, as it were, and looked quite ungainly, I thought, on the ground. But once you get up into the air, it had a good aerodynamic shape, and obviously, having been designed originally as an airliner, the cabin was very extensive. I mean, you can get, at a pinch, you could get 20 bods in the cabin area, although operationally, of course, that space was taken up in at least some of it in other ways. It was possible to and of course it was done, it was used quite frequently, where there was likely to be a need for a fuller coverage of the aircraft against attack as possible. It was possible we had a Lewis gun, which could be, well, we had two. One could be fired out of each window because the body of the aircraft had a line of five or six windows, something like that. And then there was the turret at the back with a small toilet place. And as the pilot was sitting in his seat, if you can imagine that on the left at the front and the cockpit, on his right there were steps going down to the lower level where the navigator had his table, because there was a glass nose to the aircraft with glass panels in each of the sides, so the navigator had probably the best view of any aircraft, apart from actually looking straight down. You couldn't do that. So I think that's about all I can say, really. Better to look at a photograph, and I'm sure there are many that people can look at still.
Was the first stage then a familiarisation on the ground with the aircraft?
Oh, yes. Spent quite a bit of time going round the usual, pointing out the usual important parts. Again, the pitot head for the airspeed indicator. It even had a fluffy or a woolly sort of cover for it, which is just as well, of course, in Iceland and Greenland. Pointing out the usual features, the two features, well, the pair of features that I didn't particularly like was the undercarriage, in that. And I regretted that they weren't an English type, shall I say, or a British type. They only had struts on the inside of the wheels, one strut only, a good strong strut, of course, but whereas if you look at British aircraft at the time, they had, and particularly the Anson, which of course had a very good, strong undercarriage. They had struts on each side of the wheel, the landing wheel, which gave them added strength, particularly against sideways stress. The door was down the left-hand side, about two-thirds of the way down the port side. Inside the door body, the body of the door, was the emergency flotation. Can't think of a word. It blew up into a sort of...
dinghy.
Dinghy, yes, dinghy's the word. it was all very cleverly kept inside the door, and the door itself, on immersion, we were told, would separate. And when immersed in the water, and there was some reaction which freed the cover, and I think this was largely when the dinghy inflated itself, so that was an important thing to make sure was always there, ready for use.
Would you be giving pilot's notes as well, Ted, to familiarise yourselves with?
I got my Hudson pilot's notes after the war. I don't know why. Perhaps I was given them. I don't remember being given them. Anyway, I didn't have them. But I had plenty of notes of my own, and I can't say that having read the pilot's notes, in retrospect, they didn't give me any information I didn't already know.
So this familiarisation, when you're first taken around the aircraft, is it an instructor who takes you around, or do you go around as a group with and get a kind of overview?
Oh, no, individually, with the instructor. and of course, by yourself, if you have any sense, to get to know everything in your own way as soon as possible.
Would you spend time doing that then? Would you go and then check it yourself just to make sure you were aware of everything that he'd spoken to about on sort of the external and the internal side of the aircraft?
Oh, yes, yes. No. That's up to the individual. I mean, I can only speak for myself. I didn't feel confident in any aircraft until I'd been sitting in it and imagined it.
How daunting is it to come to something like a Hudson with all those switches and dials after flying something that you're somewhere you've got a confidence in how you can fly it? Is it a daunting prospect to look at something like that?
Well, it's difficult to remember. I mean, it's no use writing down in your notes at that stage when you're just going to begin on a new aircraft with operational experience ahead of you. Difficult to remember whether you wrote down this is not a daunting aircraft or oh yes it is. I can only say that excuse me. The first thing we were told about Hudsons was by a member of the ground crew. Excuse me a minute. Learning later that this was Air Vice Marshal Bennett's opinion of the Hudson when he first flew it, before deciding whether it was possible, it was feasible to fly the Hudson across the Atlantic rather than have to ship them all. Eventually this became, of course, the way that they all came, in hops across from Northeast America, through Gander and Greenland, Iceland, and to Prestwick. His opinion of the Hudson was that it had tricky characteristics, It could drop a wing if bounced. Quite a nasty stall. A fine performer, but a handful. Could be dangerous if careless. But that was afterwards. I read that afterwards. And the first thing that we learned about the Hudson when we were going out to it was from a member of the ground crew. He said, because there were other aircraft on the field at Silloth, including Anson's and Bothers, he said, oh, Hudson's, they swing a lot on takeoff. So we had a very good introduction to them, and I think it made us, you know, a bit more key of eve, as it were. But I can't remember. I mean, I just can't remember whether I know I wanted to fly it, and that's all.
So what was the next stage? You've obviously familiarised yourself with it. Is it the first flight that you would go? Would you go with an instructor, and would you do a certain set pattern of things again?
Oh, yes, yes. It was the same repetitive pattern. I don't know whether it still is. I'm sure it can't be with modern aircraft, because when they take off, they seem to have disappeared in a few minutes. They forget where the airfield was if they had to do a circuit around it. No, it was much the same. We'd take off, he would fly it and perform various turns, dives, all the rest of it. He'd do an imaginary approach, not to the airfield, but somewhere in the sky. And then finish up with some simple, straightforward, fine, straight and level turns and so on, and then say it's yours. And so then you familiarize yourself with it. And the important thing, of course, was to be able to fly it round the circuit and to do a circuit and landing as soon as possible, and then you were free to go on to more important and more advanced uses of the various controls.
How did it handle?
Well, I thought it was very easy to handle. I think I was fortunate in having long legs, because it does need at times a firm foot on the rudder, particularly if you drop a wing as you're coming into land. Most aircraft, you can pick them up, as it's called, pick up a wing, using aileron with the rudder. In other words, you bring the stick over to the right to bring the left wing up. If that had dropped. But with the Hudson, you'd get a wing up and it would drop slightly using rudder rather than the aileron. But it was quite remarkably flexible. We could stooge around at 120 knots for hours. I remember it's 20 knots. 120 knots on uh, 1800 revs and I forget how many inches of boost. Anyway, and also, you could get up to just over 200 knots top speed, depending, of course, on the load you were carrying. If you were wanting to get away from some 109s off the coast of Norway or whatever, in emergency, if you still had your bomb load, you would drop it, because it did make quite a difference.